You got to have better password management and control, rotation, and other measures in place. It's just this type of hygiene's just got to go away. And what I mean is, let's get better as an industry. Let's get better at things. And that's the call out, I think, here, Chris, is just another reminder that good security hygiene goes a long way.
How you doing today, Matt Bromley?
Hey, Chris, what's going on, sir? I'm doing well. Happy summer to you. Happy June. That background's looking a little more official, looking like someone's getting his space set up, which, you know, was only supposed to be done a couple weeks ago, but we won't hold it against you.
Yeah, I managed to record a demo video in here last night, so it's still pretty chaotic, but feeling good about it. It's nice to start to have things back to normal. Yeah, I've been distracted planting raspberry bushes and blueberry bushes and grapevines, and now that I got a piece of dirt, I'm going to make it sing.
I like it, man. You got to do something that doesn't involve a keyboard for a while. It's an important component to have.
And I feel like with the rising prices of food, I'm going to do well in this venture here. So,
dude, not going to lie, the rising prices of food, rising prices of everything, man, if I could make anything grow, I would probably prioritize just basic living essentials before anything else. But man, what a day we live in. I mean, hey, at least my AI subscription hasn't gone up that much recently.
Speaking of AI subscriptions, this first article, I think everybody's probably aware of the U.S. government banning Fable 5, which we'll dive into in a minute. But I just want to, I was working with Fable for the 2 days that it was available, and I had a nightmare the night of the second night.
Really?
Because I did something that was like touch technical, touch design, touched a bunch of different things, and I gave it a single kind of misspelt one sentence prompt, and it did everything, and it was like ready for production in that one hit. And it freaked me out a little. I know it wasn't the most technical thing, but just like the breadth of the things that it touched. So it definitely feels like a step shift.
Too fast, too broad, because the way you're describing this, it sounds like a positive to me.
Oh, but it was a positive, but it actually freaked me out because it was so good. And it was kind of this existential moment where it's like, I thought I was kind of special before, like the magic robot wrangler, and it's like, I don't even know if we're going to need the robot wrangler soon. So,
I don't know. It's getting to a quick point here where I feel like they keep adding these capabilities on, like skills and routines and, you know, like all these different, like, hey, here's different ways you can use it. But the models get to a point where even the models don't even need that stuff anymore. You can just like point it and the model's like, oh, here's the 10 things I need to do to be successful. Done, 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 done. All right, cool. Yeah. Enjoy your coffee. What's next? And it's like, I didn't even enter yet. Like, I didn't press return. Like, how did you figure this out before I even typed it out?
Yeah. So anyway, the article reports that the U.S. government issued an export control order restricting access to Anthropic's newly released Claude Mythos 5 and Fable 5 models for foreign nationals. In response, Anthropic suspended access to both models on June 12th to comply with the order. According to Anthropic, the government's concerns center on national security risks associated with frontier AI models, particularly Mythos 5, which is described as having a potential to discover critical software vulnerabilities and develop novel exploits. Anthropic stated that Mythos was already intended for a limited set of partners and that Fable 5 included safeguards that redirect certain cybersecurity and biology related requests to an earlier model, Claude Opus 4.8. Anthropic also said it had not received evidence of a harmful jailbreak specific to Mythos. The article notes that the government has not publicly provided a detailed justification for the export controls. Semaphore reported that White House concerns may have been linked to a suspected China-connected threat group obtaining access to the model, although Anthropic officially blocks access from China. David Sachs, an advisor to President Donald Trump, stated that a trusted partner reported a jailbreak and claimed Anthropic CEO Dario Amati declined requests to address it. Sachs characterized the export control as a reluctant measure and said the administration hopes the restrictions can be lifted after safety concerns are resolved. Several security professionals interviewed in the article questioned whether the restrictions would meaningfully prevent adversaries from obtaining comparable capabilities. One of the folks at a company called Calvo argued that geopolitical rivals likely possess significant undeclared AI capabilities. And John Strand of Black Hills Information Security similarly stated that Mythos-level capabilities are not confined to a small number of U.S. companies and are being developed across multiple countries and models. Noella Murata of Xscape described the restrictions as potentially only a minor obstacle for nation state and financially motivated attackers, particularly if unauthorized access had already occurred. She also suggested that limiting access would encourage movement towards decentralized open source alternatives while comparable models remain unavailable elsewhere. The strongest criticism highlighted in the article came from members of the cybersecurity community who argue that the restrictions may harm defenders more than attackers. Katie Musaris of Luta Security reviewed the research behind the reported jailbreak and explained that researchers used vulnerable code samples and ASM model to help identify and fix security issues. She argued that removing such defensive capabilities would reduce the usefulness of the models for security work. Musaris signed an open letter alongside prominent figures including Alex Stamos, Casey Ellis, and Bruce Schneier, urging the government to reverse the controls. The letter argues that similar capabilities can be reproduced using other models, that Anthropic is already addressing the findings, and that limiting access could weaken U.S. competitiveness while doing little to hinder adversaries. Sophos CEO Joe Levy and Black Hills Information Security's John Strand also argued that defenders require access to advanced AI tools for security operations, software development, vulnerability management, and assessments, and that restricting these tools could make defensive work more difficult. So yeah, I mean, it is kind of wild. I saw a guy named Pliny the Liberator, who a friend of mine, John V, introduced me to, and he had apparently jailbroken it in the first hour using like a combined like narrative and hieroglyphs and like all these different techniques that are fairly widely known. So I don't know how genuine that is. Pliny the Liberator is quite well known for you know, freeing models, hence the Liberator. I think it's probably likely. I think it's just inherently hard to completely put guardrails on these things in that determined attackers will be able to get around it. But it's also, like this article states, the cat's out of the bag, genie's out of the bottle. You know, Pandora's box has been opened. I don't know if there's any way to try and stuff it back in there.
Yeah, Chris, you're bringing up a really valid point, but also one that's kind of existed across tools and technology for years and years now. This, you know, I feel like, and there's a lot of really great people named in this article who have very reputable opinions and have spoken up on a lot of great things. And I'm not discounting any of their opinions, but where I think it's maybe, you know, the best to kind of lean in or some of the comments that ring true the most are things like, hey, look, the adversaries are going to go open source routes anyways. There's likely models that have reached this level already and they're available for everyone out there. Like, we're in the same category again of the folks with the spotlights and the big funding get all the big news cycles. And it's not a bad thing, right? I'm not saying it's not for a focus and discussion point, but like this idea of, oh, well, no one can use Fable now, we've squashed that threat, just isn't true. Number one. Number two, I have to remind you, Chris and I, our listeners here, Chris and I talked about this a few weeks ago. Like, it's not like Mythos opened some gate that had previously been closed. And I just want to be clear about this. It's not like Mythos opened some gate that had previously been closed off to the world. And now we have some like really significant, oh my gosh, the world's going to be full of 0 days type of concern. What we have are models that are more effective at identifying like software weaknesses and vulnerabilities and stuff like that. Like, they're getting smarter because they're getting trained on more up-to-date code and they're being given certain cybersecurity directives and things like that. That doesn't go away, right? So I kind of want to maybe echo the sentiment of the article here, which is this is meant to be kind of like a warning thing. But I don't think the warning is, oh my gosh, Fable is going to ruin the world. I think the warning is, as future goes on, these models are going to get smarter and smarter at what they can do, comma, with correct or incorrect, aka malicious human intentions, right? Because Chris, I'm gonna ask you like a straightforward question. If you're a software developer, meaning you're writing a single piece of software and you've built a little company around this, and let's say you've got a handful of customers, you know, some of them are some good names, and you're kind of providing for your family and stuff like that, right? A really simple use case. And you point one of these models at it and you're like, hey, I don't want to become the face of a compromise. Analyze my software for weaknesses and vulnerabilities, right? Just a strictly, you know, innocuous thing, right? And it does it and it comes back and is like, hey, here's these two or three things you should fix. So you push fixes for them, you push them up, and now your software doesn't get exploited as a result of like a phishing campaign or something like that, you know, and you're not some esoteric software being discussed on the Cybersecurity Defenders podcast in the future. Well, if you change the person and you change their intentions, now it's malicious. And it's kind of like at no point in time was it, oh, you need to opt into this model in order to do that successfully. So like we still have to deal with the human maliciousness and the human behavior here. I think I mentioned this earlier, like all malware is software. Not all software is malware. It's only becomes malware when it's designed or used maliciously. Mimikatz was designed as a testing tool. It wasn't designed as the adversarial Swiss knife, a Swiss Army knife of password cracking or something, or password dumping. So this idea of like, oh, well, now it's going to get bad is like, no, that opportunity's always been there. Maybe the barrier is lowered a little bit, but it didn't create new things that we've never seen before. So really where I'm going with this, Chris, is folks, adjust your risk profiles accordingly. And, you know, just be prepared for what I'm going to consider like AI-enabled adversaries. And what that means is the models are going to continue to get smarter, which means an AI-enabled or an AI-assisted adversary is going to become faster or smarter or more capable. But even if we shut down access to Fable or 5.5 or whatever model you want to choose, then they'll just go to another model. It doesn't take away the concept of preparing for that threat is what I'm trying to get to here. And hopefully that's resonating.
And I think we're in like this weird in between space right now where like there's a whole bunch of like legacy software, we'll call it, that was human written and human reviewed that has some probably glaring vulnerabilities that haven't been discovered. But to your example, as we go forward, normal folks who are writing small pieces of software will have access to these models to create more secure software. So it will be more of a level playing field. But I think right now, and especially in the next year or two, we're going to just see an explosion of vulnerability exploits by, you know, low-skilled threat actors leveraging AI. And we just got to get through this part and hopefully it gets better.
That's right. And we'll make it through. Don't worry. Like security will find a way. We always find a way. And then, you know, we'll be here in a year being like, can you believe it? Like, look at this. Claude 8 or whatever is out, right?
Oh, God.
With all these crazy new features it's got. I mean, the...
I'll be working at the farmer's market by then, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, no, I don't want to speak for you, but fingers crossed you'll be working at the farmer's market. But I don't know. Like, I tell you right now, if my option became planting stuff in the ground, I might not be too dismayed from that. No, point being, it's, you know, obviously what's good for good is also good for bad. Blue teamers, defenders, you've also got an opportunity to level up immensely here. And I'm not talking about go buy an AI enabled product. I'm talking about you can also utilize AI to enrich your team and make your team a little bit smarter. So like, you know, I mean, geez, I don't want to give out free advice, but like point your AI, if an adversary points their AI at a code base, point your AI at your detection rule corpus, point your AI at telemetry. Like you also can undertake these really cool steps to advance you forward and help shore up your defenses and stuff like that. I mean, it's what's you know, what's good for one is good for all. So you, defenders, don't get stuck wrapped inside of, oh my gosh, the adversaries have all these tools and now we're helpless. And I'm like, hey, a gun for them is a gun for me. A bazooka for them is a bazooka for me too. Like use it to your advantage.
And I had like a flash of a Bugs Bunny cartoon in my head there for a second.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm for some reason, what's Roger Rabbit is in my head right now. I don't know why.
All right. Next up, this one was pointed out by Ken Weston on the Lima Charlie team. Looks pretty ugly. ServiceNow disclosed a security incident involving an unauthenticated access flaw on an API endpoint that allowed users to query data from customer instances without proper authentication. The company detected what it described as anomalous activity and notified affected customers through a support bulletin and direct support cases. On June 5th, 2026, ServiceNow deployed a security update to hosted customer instances that modified the API endpoint configuration so that only authenticated users could access it. According to the support bulletin, The vulnerability could allow an unauthenticated user under certain circumstances to gain broader access to service instances than intended. ServiceNow confirmed that the flaw was exploited and that attackers successfully queried customer instance tables. The company did not disclose exactly what data was accessed. ServiceNow environments often contain enterprise data such as IT support tickets, employee records, internal documentation, asset inventories, security incident reports, workflow information, and configuration details. The article notes that support tickets are especially attractive targets because they can contain credentials, API tokens, authentication secrets, and other sensitive troubleshooting information. Although ServiceNow did not publicly release technical details about the vulnerability, administrators discussing the incident on Reddit suggested it involved a particular REST endpoint. According to those discussions, the endpoint may have been configured with an authentication equals false flag, allowing unauthenticated requests. The June 5th security update reportedly changed that setting to require authentication. Administrators also shared indicators of compromise, including API requests originating from a particular IP address and recommending reviewing logs for activity involving the affected endpoint. ServiceNow stated that the issue primarily affected customers running the Australia platform release, as well as customers on earlier releases who had made certain configuration changes. The company said it opened support cases with impacted organizations and advised that customers who had not received a support case were not believed to be affected. At the time of reporting, ServiceNow had not decided whether a CVE would be assigned to the vulnerability. The company recommends reviewing particular logs, examining exposed records for sensitive information, rotating credentials or tokens that may have been shared through support workflows, and ensuring API logging is enabled. An update published on June 10th added additional context. ServiceNow stated that it believes the observed activity was likely associated with security researchers or customer-led research connected to bug bounty submissions rather than malicious threat actors. The company also disclosed that it had received a confidential bug bounty report describing a similar issue on April 22, 2026. However, the security update was not deployed until June 5th, after actively targeting customer instances had reportedly begun several days earlier. Bleeping Computer said it asked ServiceNow about the delay between the bug bounty submission and the deployment of the fix and would update the article if a response is provided. So yeah, that's kind of nasty. I hate to see them write that people are putting authentication keys in tickets. Like, get some kind of locker, some kind of hive where you pass, like, you know, credential protected access to those keys each other. Don't put them in a ticket.
I think the words you're looking for is just like good security hygiene.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. No offense.
Yeah. One password's maybe a good thing. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that one. Hey, look, folks, if you're a ServiceNow user, please follow ServiceNow's recommendations here. I do like the final turnaround that it was like, hey, maybe this is related to bug bounty stuff. Maybe that's what this is. Would be cool. It was definitely a little bit of a cry is the wrong word, but like definitely a little bit of like a watch out moment. And I remember a few folks talking about this, but great to see if it might actually be some sort of security testing. I would be much happier for that. But check your logs, folks, and make sure you upgrade and patch. I mean, that's really it. Like, if you're a ServiceNow user, you know the criticality of this tool to your environment. So patch it, double check your logs, make sure you didn't get compromised, but then let the platform push out its updates so that we can get a kind of an idea as to whether this was related to testing or bug bounty, which is a confirmation I'd like to see personally.
And if your company provides an API that has access to sensitive information, please make sure that it requires authentication.
Yeah, that too. This might have gotten picked up in some sort of a vulnerability test there, Chris, but who knows?
Yeah, it's kind of wild. Kind of wild for a company that size. But anyway, I'm going to continue punching down or sideways or punching companies. Here's a large-scale credential harvesting campaign dubbed FortiBleed is actively targeting Fortinet firewalls and VPN gateways and has already compromised more than 30,000 internet-facing devices across 194 countries. Researchers at SOC Radar uncovered the operation after discovering an exposed server used by the attackers, which provided visibility into their infrastructure, victim database, automation systems, and credential repository. According to the researchers, the attackers possessed more than 30,791 verified username and password combinations associated with devices belonging to companies and government organizations worldwide. The credentials were not speculative or untested. They had been successfully validated through automated systems operated by the threat actors. The investigation found no evidence that the attackers exploited a new Fortinet vulnerability. Instead, the campaign relies on credential theft and credential reuse. Researchers determined that many affected devices were protected by weak security practices, including the continued use of generic administrator accounts, built-in Fortinet accounts, and passwords that had never been rotated after previous breaches. Security experts cited in the article emphasized that the operation demonstrates the long-term impact of organizations failing to change credentials that may have been exposed in earlier incidents. The scope of the compromise spans government, telecommunications, healthcare, education, financial services, and critical infrastructure organizations. Telecommunications organizations accounted for more than 5,600 compromised devices, while government entities represent hundreds of affected organizations across more than 100 domains. More than 20% of the impacted devices belong to enterprises generating over $1 billion in annual revenue. India and the United States accounted for nearly one-third of the identified credential compromises, though affected organizations were distributed across every major region, including Europe, Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and the Americas. SockRadar described the operation as a highly automated and self-sustaining attack chain. Attackers continuously scan the internet for Fortinet devices, then use credential stuffing, password spraying, and credential reuse attacks against exposed management and VPN interfaces. Once access is obtained, compromised devices are allegedly used to monitor network traffic and collect additional credentials. Those newly harvested credentials are then fed back into the attacker's automated system, allowing the campaign to expand and compromise additional devices. Researchers characterize the process as effectively feeding itself through continuous credential collection and validation. The report also notes that technical evidence points towards Russia-speaking threat actors, and the victim selection appears heavily concentrated among organizations located in NATO member countries. Researchers suggested that the operation may involve not only financial motives, but also cyber espionage objectives, citing the presence of credentials associated with what appear to be a defense industry VPN endpoint. To mitigate risk, organizations using Fortinet products are advised to immediately rotate administrative and VPN credentials, enable multi-factor authentication, review authentication and VPN logs for suspicious activity, restrict management interfaces from public internet exposure when possible, update devices to current firmware versions, and conduct incident response investigations if compromise is suspected. I'll retract. This one doesn't appear to be on Fortinet. This is just poor security practices across the board. With some well-known passwords that were leaked in earlier breaches that may or may not have been Fortinet's fault.
Oh, to be clear, we're not mentioning any other vendor names inside of this article. No, you're right. This is not a hit on Fortinet whatsoever. Just pure credential theft. Hat tip to the article for calling it out, even as just this is just pure credential theft. Look, folks, you got to have. And look, this is no one's fault, Chris. I don't have anyone to point to other than just general awareness and statement. You got to have better password management and control, rotation, and other measures in place. It's got to kind of become best practice, I think. Some of the discussions or some of the mentions around passwords weren't even changed after the end of breaches, or there were situations where it's just kind of old and stale credentials and stuff like that. It's just this type of hygiene's just got to go away. And what I mean is, let's get better as an industry. Let's get better at things. And that's the call out, I think, here, Chris, is just another reminder that good security hygiene goes a long way. This is the type of article that most organizations shouldn't be in. Right. Especially, it calls it out here where they're like, there's some enterprises generating more than $1 billion of revenue and that kind of stuff. I don't look at revenue as a direct correlation of security capabilities. I look at it as a direct correlation of adversarial targeting likelihood. Mm-hmm. But the flip side of that is, I mean, this is the type of stuff that just, you should have some security folks in place. And these are the types of like low hanging fruit things that we should take care of and just really shouldn't be out there. That's my thought.
Yeah. All right. Last one I have is more of an interest piece because I didn't even know any of this existed. Ukraine has been granted access to the European Union's Cybersecurity Reserve, giving the country the ability to request assistance from EU-approved cybersecurity experts during major cyber attacks that exceed its own response capabilities. The European Commission announced that member states approved Ukraine's participation in the program, which is managed by the European Union's Agency for Cybersecurity. The reserve consists of private cybersecurity companies that can be rapidly deployed to support governments and operators of critical infrastructure during significant cyber incidents. The Cybersecurity Reserve was created to provide incident response services, technical expertise, and recovery assistance when participating countries face cyber attacks beyond their internal capacity. Ukraine becomes the second non-EU country to gain access to the reserve after Moldova, which was granted participation last year due to increasing cyber threats and influence operations linked to Russia. For Ukraine, the decision comes as the country continues to experience sustained cyber activity associated with its ongoing conflict with Russia. The head of cyber information security at Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council described the move as an important step in integrating Ukraine into European cybersecurity structures. She noted that Ukraine is effectively becoming part of the EU's collective cyber defense framework even before formally joining the European Union. The development follows the recent decision by EU member states to begin formal accession negotiations with Kyiv, marking another step in Ukraine's path towards eventual EU membership. Under the arrangement, Ukraine can formally request emergency European assistance when a cyber attack overwhelms its domestic incident response sources. Specialized teams from across the EU could then provide services such as digital forensics, incident response, containment activities, and system recovery support. The reserve can also contribute to post-incident recovery efforts, help modernize effective systems, facilitate cyber threat intelligence sharing, and support improvements to national cyber response capabilities. Ukraine officials emphasize that the relationship is intended to be collaborative rather than one-sided. According to the woman from the Ukrainian organization, Ukraine already contributes significant expertise to European cybersecurity efforts by sharing intelligence on Russian cyber operations, participating in joint cybercrime investigations, and supporting attribution activities alongside Europol and other European institutions. Years of defending against Russian cyber campaigns have given Ukrainian government agencies and private sector organizations extensive experience in detecting, mitigating, and recovering from large-scale cyber incidents. Ukraine also hopes that domestic cybersecurity companies will eventually be eligible to participate directly in the Cybersecurity Reserve as trusted service providers under the EU Cyber Solidarity Act. European Commission Executive Vice President Henna Verkkunen said that Ukraine's inclusion strengthens collective European cyber defenses and reflects a principle of solidarity underlying the EU's digital security strategy. The decision also reflects a broader trend of expanding cybersecurity cooperation between Brussels and Kyiv since Russia's 2022 invasion, including through bilateral agreements and initiatives such as the Tallinn mechanism. I'm not sure what that last bit is, but I find this interesting because, you know, Russia's, I'm not a geopoliticist, but Russia's big beef with Ukraine joining the EU is that NATO will be encroaching on its border. And this feels like, you know, they're pushing towards that sort of through the side door. And I just wonder if this is going to elevate tensions and if cyber activities actually start to classify as battlefield activities. And like, it feels like this could be a fuzzy area that could increase tension.
I was just more surprised, to be honest with you. I think you called this out in the very beginning of like, I didn't know this was like a bat signal that could be fired in the air and stuff like that of like, hey, you know, FYI, if you need some additional cybersecurity support, we've got the EU Cybersecurity Reserve, a pool of private companies that can be rapidly deployed. And Chris, for the longest time in my life, I thought like, isn't that just a retainer? Like, isn't that just a cybersecurity retainer? Like you call up, but hey, here we are. It's a reserve provided, as you mentioned, for IR and stuff like that. I'm not surprised that the recent invocation of this has been related to attacks from the Kremlin and whatnot. I don't have any comments to speak about Russia other than, you know, the association with some of the attacks against like Ukraine and Eastern European countries and stuff like that. And this is like some of those situations where companies need help and they're able to reach out and they're able to get it. So, you know, organizations or the government of Ukraine or whatever it is, I think is like, hey, we want to be able to throw up the bat signal and call help in. I find this part to be a pretty interesting thing to have there because it makes you wonder what were they doing before and then what would make you need to put this up that you didn't call for it before. And then the third question I have, Chris, which I don't think either of us are going to be able to answer here, is like, how long does this process take? And here's what I mean, and I'm using a real world example here. If you're in an organization and you get DDoSed or something like that, right? You call up Akamai or Cloudflare and they kind of like stand in front of the DNS traffic for you and they've got the ability to weather the storm and they kind of handle it for you. But you only really needed to call them in like specific situations. You know, you don't call Akamai in because you got a phishing attack, right? But then perhaps more interestingly enough is like, so what types of situations would spurn this to occur? Is it any type of breach? Is it breaches that, or like intrusions that reach a certain level? Or is it literally just like, hey, we've been taxed, our resources have been depleted for so long, we're needing help here? And Chris, I think that's where, and the reason I went this roundabout logical route, that's where when we talk about nations getting foreign support that encroach on borders and stuff like that, that's that kind of like maybe odd middle ground or loophole or something like that, where it's like, hey, our resources are so depleted, we need this thing. And it's like, perfect, the EU opens its doors up for you. I don't know enough about geopolitics to answer most of the questions that I asked. That's just where my head goes from a kind of what, you know, what does it take to get here perspective? And I really start to wonder, like, what was happening before and then what happens now? Like, how, you know, is this kind of a constant stream of private companies now have access to Ukrainian data and Ukrainian incidents, and they basically just flipped on a massive IR retainer, right? Or is it?
Well,
like,
yeah,
hey,
I suspect a lot of it is funding, like you mentioned. I think it's probably a way to access funding. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the other side of it, which I find odd, is, and I'm reading through the article here, but like a pool of private cybersecurity companies that can be rapidly deployed to help governments and critical infrastructure. Like, were those companies unavailable before? And that's kind of where I'm at. Is like, was there some sort of a line? And that's why I was wondering.
Well, I think it's just who's paying the bill. That would be my guess.
Maybe it is. Yeah, you might be right about that. It might be who's paying the bill, in which case it's definitely going to upset, you know, folks on the on the Moscow side. But still, I always find it interesting of like, what's the trigger for this, and then when do they actually access it? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And is there a big red button on somebody's desk somewhere?
Yeah, and then is it also like, and I don't know the answers here. It might be embedded in the article, or it might be embedded in some of the announcements somewhere. But kind of like this idea of, and Chris, I'm not doubting it. I'm just throwing some interesting questions out here, which is, it's expected to be reciprocal. Ukraine is not just a recipient of cyber assistance. It's also expected that they will share intel back. You and I, over the past years, we've commented on attacks targeting Ukraine officials, Ukrainian companies. They've been sharing intel. So like, this is kind of like, to me, some of this article just reads like, hey, you know, we lifted a wall and now you can do this stuff. But I think you're right. It's probably opening up funding. Everything else mm-hmm. is just maybe normal course of business. But I there might be something here that I don't know about and you don't know about, and maybe we'll discover one day.
Yeah, or read about it in the news.
let's hope not.
Yeah. All right, sir. Thanks for coming out again. I don't even know where we're at. I think like 350, somewhere like that. Oh, so
cool. I love it, man. Now we're moving
back. If you've listened this long, give us a like or a comment so we know we're not speaking into the void. It's always nice to hear from folks. And if you're going to Black Hat, get at me. I'm going to bring a giant suitcase full of T-shirts. Lima Charlie's gonna have a booth, so come by and say hi. And I think we're gonna be doing training with Black Hills Information Security too, so if you're interested in learning how to build agentic workflows into your security operations, again, get at me. I'll send you an invite. We'll have some drinks and food up there and a suite and hands-on training with the Black Hills folks, so should be pretty good.
Chris, I will also be at Black Hat this year. We should look at doing an episode recording while we're there.
100%, and grab dinner or something, man. I haven't seen you in a while. I miss you.
All of the above, my friend. All of the above. Let's do it. Folks, anyone who's listening, it is middle of June. If you're listening and would like to, I don't know, I don't want to say join, but like come and, you know, hang out with us for an episode recording or something like that. Let us know in the comments or give us some feedback.
Yeah, we're going to have a nice suite at the Mandalay Bay, so we can always take it over and do it right.
There we go. Love it. Awesome. All right, Greg. Okay. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
And that brings us to the end of another Intel Chat. You can support this show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend or subscribing and giving us a rating or leaving a comment on your chosen podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation and access the intel we talk about in real time, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.